We have a government that is acting not like a government for all the people.
Right.
It's acting like mobsters. Makes sense because we elected a convicted criminal president of the United States. We elected a man who is a sociopath. Mob organizations are run by sociopaths.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah Longwell. He's George Conway. I'm not Sarah Longwell. I'm actually her best friend. My name is JVL from The Bulwark. George, it's been a minute. How are you, buddy?
I'm hanging in there. How are you? I know the two of us always like to get together to talk about our optimistic view of the world.
I mean, things are going great.
Oh, they're just fabulous.
Couldn't be better.
Fabulous.
So we're going to start today. We're going to start with some First Amendment stuff and some RICO stuff, since that's
a
thing that's happening.
What amendment?
Exactly. The First Amendment. So we had Todd Blanche on CNN explaining the dangerous things that are happening to the president of the United States at Joe Stonecrab, and suggesting how the Department of Justice might use RICO laws to clean that up. Let's just listen to what Todd had to say, and then I want to ask you some questions.
As you know, RICO has been used to go after, like, Al-Qaeda, MS-13, the Gambino family. How would something like that protest fall under a RICO charge?
That's not what we use RICO for only. RICO is available to all kinds of organizations committing crimes and committing wrongful acts, not just organized crime or ISIS or terrorist organizations. And so it depends. So is it, again, sheer happenstance that individuals show up at a restaurant where the president is trying to enjoy dinner in Washington, D.C., and accost him with vile words and vile anger, and meanwhile he's simply trying to have dinner? Does it mean it's just completely random that they showed up? Maybe. Maybe, but to the extent that it's part of an organized effort to inflict harm and terror and damage to the United States, there's potential investigations there. And that's what the president was saying yesterday in the Oval Office, and what he also has said in the days before that as well.
But were those women in the restaurant inflicting harm or terror or damage by protesting the president of the United States? I mean, they were just shouting, basically, in his vicinity.
I mean, repeat what you just said. I mean, honestly, so you're asking whether there's damage done by four individuals screaming and yelling at the president of our United States while he's trying to have dinner. That can't be a serious question. That cannot be a serious question. I mean, it's true that there's a difference between
people
shouting
can protest the
and
president.
committing an assassination,
there are supporters outside,
which is what happened to Charlie. Well, it depends. There's nothing wrong with peaceful protests, and nobody has ever said so. Of all the people in this country, President Trump knows exactly what it's like to have people protest against him. But what he's talking about and what the administration is talking about is organized efforts by individuals who are not present at the protests, but they're funding these protests, and they're not protests. They're inflicting damage and harm and actually assaulting officers. They're damaging vehicles, and that's the conduct that we're trying to stop.
So, George, I mean, I have so many questions. The first is, how does, I mean, Todd Blanche is a lawyer.
He's also a liar.
Oh, also a liar. Those things are, they nearly rhyme. Harm, terror, and damage suffered by the president of the United States because of the four ladies who yelled at him at Joe Stonecrab. I
the
guess
appetizers went bad.
Oof,
that's harm. I mean, that's harm.
Is any of that actionable? Like, I mean, I just as a real.
No. It
okay.
is that was the most absurd, gaslighting, this embarrassing display. I just can't imagine how somebody. A lawyer, a trained lawyer, a former prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for, I think, the Southern District of New York, can say such dribble. The Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act is designed to prohibit, punish racketeering. What is racketeering? Racketeering involves organizations that engage in a continued pattern. Literally, that's what the statute says. A continuing pattern of criminality that is specifically defined in what are called predicate acts. The RICO statute lists a bunch of things that are bad, that are predicate acts. And if you have a minimum, you have to have a minimum of two, but you really have to have a whole series over a long period of time designed as, you know, done in concert as part of an operation of some sort that's called an enterprise, and to cause harm, real harm. Okay. Here are the kinds of things that I could pull out the statute in Title 18 of the U.S. Code, but the kinds of things that are on that list are murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, blowing shit up, terrorism, international terrorism, blowing an airplane up, and there can be, you know, gambling could be, right? Illegal gambling or massive fraud. All sorts of things can fall in that rubric because it's what triggered the passage of RICO in 1968 as part of, I think, the Organized Crime Control Act was organized crime. This was designed to get the mob, the boss. It was designed so that, let's say you have a bunch of bookies and then you have a bunch of Shylocks and you have a bunch of people who are collecting money that they borrowed at usurious rates, that they were borrowed at usurious rates. And the way they collect is that you either pay up or they break your legs. Mm-hmm. And then they kill the people who don't cooperate with them or who turn state's evidence on them. All of these things. That's the kind of thing that RICO was designed to fight. Protests, no. Now, if this were a series, if this were an organization that was engaging in violence, like shooting into the restaurant, and they did it not just once, but more than twice, over a period of long time, because there has to be continuity, and the law actually, you know, the case law says continuity, yeah, you could have a problem. But having people sit next to you being obnoxious in a restaurant, I mean, it's just an absurd joke. And it's really kind of pathetic. I mean, what kind of, is the president of the United States such a weak and pathetic snowflake that he can't handle somebody saying, you know, that he's bad? I it's crazy. And it's like, they had a right to be there. Unless those other diners had the right to be there unless the owners of the restaurant asked them to leave, which I guess they probably did at some point. But even if you were trespassing in the restaurant, trespassing in a restaurant would not constitute a predicate act under RICO because it's
a misdemeanor. No.
If that, I don't know. And even there, now, if they had actually caused some harm to the president in a manner that's prescribed by the law, and there are things you can't, you know, you couldn't throw, if they threw a fork at the president, okay, that would be assault.
How about a stone crab?
Stone crab. I mean, a stone crab gets to the, you know, you're getting to, I mean, on the sandwich scale. The Subway sandwich scale, it probably would be more serious on the, on the sandwich scale because, stone crabs can have these sharp edges to them and they're kind of harder than maybe pastrami might be and mayonnaise. And then, of course, it's the president of the United States. You know, you assault the president of the United States, there is probably a statute that says you can't assault the president of the United States it's words cannot describe how ludicrous what that man said to Caitlin Collins in that clip. He's the deputy attorney general of the United States. And he's an embarrassment.
Well, there's a lot of this going around inside the administration. Recently, Representative Brian Mast of Florida introduced H.R. 5300, in which he sought to give the Secretary of State broad powers to revoke passports for U.S. citizens. And in one section of the bill, I think it's been withdrawn for now, there was going to be the Secretary of State would have the ability to deny passports to people that he determined had knowingly aided, assisted, abetted, or otherwise provided material support to an organization the secretary had designated as a foreign terrorist organization, which, I mean, I guess could be Antifa, since Antifa has now been declared a terrorist organization.
But it's not foreign.
Well, I think Antifa, because it isn't actually an organization, can be whatever you say it is. It could be both foreign and domestic. Mm-hmm. It could be both matter and antimatter. Because it isn't an organization. Yes, if it's not an organization, then it can be anything.
That's true. And it's right. up to the, it, and the way the administration works, it's the burden on everyone else to prove that their fantasies don't exist.
Right.
Yes, got it.
So there's that. And then there is the more serious thing that the vice president said earlier this week on Fox. He was complaining about the FBI under Christopher Wray. And he said that maybe they should have been investigating the networks that motivated, inspired, and maybe even funded Charlie Kirk's murder. So I think it's important to say that Vance is not saying that these networks funded Charlie Kirk's murder. He's saying maybe. But he does assert that there are specific networks which motivated and inspired an assassination. So that would get more towards RICO. Now, I'm not saying that these networks exist, but the vice president says that they exist. He wouldn't have said this if he didn't have proof, right? I feel like this is where we're going, right? I mean, I just get the sense that we're going to be seeing a lot of RICO, especially now that we have Antifa.
Do you think
it's all just words?
I think that's just
butching up.
Those are just words. I don't think you could draft an indictment that could withstand scrutiny under RICO for the ladies who lunched or dinner, who had dinner at that restaurant with the stone crabs. And I don't think you could really draft one in the case of the Charlie Kirk assassination, not just because there's no factual basis for it. But again, RICO requires more than one bad thing that they do. Okay. If there were let's take a real example of what would be actionable under RICO.
Okay.
Let's say there were an actual organization. Actually, it doesn't have to be an actual organization under RICO. There's something you could have an association, in fact, a bunch of people in a room. Okay. And some people may come, some people may go, but they're acting together and they kind of, there's some kind of a structure to it where they're following directions and then planning stuff and then going out and doing it. That would be an enterprise under RICO, which is what you have to have to operate an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity is the actual phrasing of the statute. And those people funded, planned, organized, set up, use whatever words you like, a pattern of political assassinations. Okay, that would be an absolutely appropriate use of RICO. But there is not a shred of evidence suggesting that that exists. And it's not sufficient to be saying that people were critical of Trump or people were critical of Charlie Kirk because of the same things he said. They thought, you know, I mean, it's an opinion somebody could reasonably have that some of the things that Charlie Kirk said were hateful. You know, it's a reasonable opinion to have, but pointing that out is not incitement to violence. It is not violence. It is not illegal. It is fundamentally what I thought, based upon what I'm reading, Charlie Kirk would have understood, which is that it's speech. And that the answer to speech We've always been taught in civic class, in constitutional law class, is that the answer to speech that you abhor or dislike, even incorrect false speech, is more speech. You rebut them, you respond, which is supposed to be what Charlie Kirk was about, according to
I'm pretty sure that's not others. That those aren't the rules we're operating under anymore, George. Well, as of the last 24 hours.
Those rules, let's be fair. Those rules do apply, but the administration and its supporters say those rules apply to them and not to the other side.
We're going to get to that in a minute, because I actually think I may know of a RICO case that I'm just going to run it by you and see yourself. All right, George, I want to run this past you. So yesterday, Brendan Carr, the head of the FCC, goes on a podcast, Benny Johnson's podcast, and he complains about Jimmy Kimmel. And what he says is that he really hopes that some of the local affiliates who may or may not have business before the FCC would decline to air Jimmy Kimmel's show, and that the Walt Disney Company, the parent company of ABC, would get rid of Jimmy Kimmel. And he says that this is going to happen one way or the other. And here's the direct quote. It can be the easy way or the hard way. Shortly after he's done, a company which owns local affiliates, which is attempting a merger, which requires FCC approval of Brendan Carr, goes and does what he requests. They say, we're not going to air Jimmy Kimmel. And then shortly after that, ABC yanks Jimmy Kimmel off the air. That sounds like racketeering in a way, right? I mean, this is like the whole racketeering thing is that if the Godfather says it would be terrible if something happened to that gentleman as he was walking home at 8 o'clock on Bleecker Street tomorrow, it would be awful. And then somebody goes and whacks the guy on Bleecker Street. You could say, okay, well, the guy who whacked him is the criminal, but also the Godfather gave the order, right? This is like racketeering. It's a pattern of criminality.
Right.
This isn't,
you have to put
it's
on
not experts
to talk about how the mobsters communicate.
Right. So again, I want to be clear. We're not talking about criminality, but we are talking about a clear and organized pattern to get around the First Amendment by using the power of government.
No, that would not
I mean, it almost seems like that's the racketeering.
Well, look, it's mob-like behavior, okay, in the following sense. Well, first of all, having the government violate the First Amendment is not a RICO predicate act.
I wasn't saying that. I'm just trying to...
It may be a violation of the First Amendment. It is a violation of the First Amendment. It is profoundly wrong, but it's not a crime. Extortion is a crime.
Oh,
okay. So I think you could argue that this was extortive, and you could piece together a theory where this is criminal. I don't think it would hold water. I think it should suffice.
Neither do I.
That the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission is trying to punish people from exercising their rights to free speech, and also threatening to withhold benefits or withhold regulatory approval on the basis of who's not nice to the president and nice to the president's agenda, which is just manifestly improper, manifestly inconsistent with the ideas behind the Federal Communications Act. And most importantly, and antithetical to our history of constitutional freedom and free speech and the First Amendment. It's a moral crime in that sense.
Yeah.
So, but your point is sort of a better one. We have a government that is acting not like a government for all the people.
Right.
It's acting like mobsters.
Yep.
You help, you scratch my back, I scratch your back. You give me something, I will provide you protection. If you don't give me, you don't make your weekly payments, we will send somebody out to make your life miserable. And maybe you'll end up in the hospital, but that's not what they're threatening here. All right. Yeah. This is you know, mob government, and which is makes sense because we elected a convicted criminal president of the United States. We elected a man who is a sociopath or a psychopath. And in order to basically run a mob organizations are run by sociopaths and psychopaths. They don't know any other way. They don't believe in cooperation. They don't believe in working cooperatively and in good faith with others. They want to bludgeon people into doing their bidding. And this is the mentality of the second Trump administration, because Trump, that is Donald Trump's mentality, and he has rid himself in the second administration of anybody who would say, no, that's wrong. We serve the people. We don't coerce people for criticizing us. We just turn the other cheek and we try to serve all the people anyway, even though some of our policies are things that some people don't like. And that was the way we thought imperfectly. The government was never perfect. It'd do stupid things, and you know, it would, you know, the stupid politics would cause the government to do things that help some people and hurt some people unfairly. But it wasn't designed. You know, we'd never had a system where the entire government is working to promote the personal grievances and whims and desires of one man.
If you wanted like the shortest possible shorthand definition between the liberalism and illiberalism, it's that liberals, and I don't mean Democrats and progressives. I mean
classical liberals,
right?
Yeah,
they acknowledge restraining factors beyond their control, which prevent them from getting things they want.
Right.
And illiberals do not. Right. Liberals will say, well, we would like to pass that bill, but we can't. Or we would like to stop this action, but we can't.
Because we accept that other people have
limits,
different opinions. We need to persuade them, but we have rules about how we resolve our differences. And at the end of the day, we work through those rules, we work through those processes, and then we accept the results. And maybe someday we'll come back and try to change them using the same process, but then we move on, because the reason why we adhere to that system is because we don't want the other guys trampling on us the way, you know, we would like to trample on them if we had our way, but we don't. We are above that.
Exactly.
Because we don't want to, Right.
A nice example of this, actually, it's a great segue, is the lawsuit filed against the New York Times this week by our president for $15 billion. Can you tell me a little bit about this suit?
Cuckoo. Cuckoo for Cuckoo Puffs. It is one of the most insane pleadings I have ever seen filed in any court. Other than, you know, the kinds of things that psychologically disturbed pro se litigants file. I mean, I once had a case when I clerked eons ago where somebody tried to sue the New York City subway system as a violation of the Eighth Amendment. You know, that's the level of which that's the level of sanity that this pleading reflects. It is absolutely just.
Is the attorney of record on this?
Some hacks from Florida, I guess, and lawyers who clearly, I mean, I've never heard of them, and they write like
hoping to get a Supreme Court appointment someday. Or at least a federal show, right? A federal judge suit. Okay.
Well, yeah,
sorry, go ahead. Look, if Emil can wind up on the federal bench, why not these guys, right?
Well,
they got
to
look at that and
say
why not me?
From reading this document, Emil is a fucking genius compared to these people. Okay? Emil Fove isn't stupid. He's craven. He's dishonest. He is untrustworthy. But he's not stupid. He's not as smart as he thinks he is. But these people are just fucking stupid. This was the most stupid document I've ever seen. I mean, one of their big complaints is, I don't know why they are fixated on this other than the fact that their mentally disturbed client is fixated on it. But it's like, they think it's bad and actionable that Donald Trump was characterized as having been discovered by Mark Burnett of the, you know, the guy who produced The Apprentice. It's like, that's not, you know, this
wasn't discovered. He was already famous, George. That is defamatory to suggest that he was not incredibly famous before Mark Burnett. I mean, if anything, you might say that Donald Trump, you might say with tears in your eyes, Mr. Trump, didn't you discover Mark Burnett? Weren't you the one who discovered Mark Burnett?
Mark Burnett, we would not know who Mark Burnett was were it not for Donald Trump.
That's amazing. What else is in there?
Look, I mean, there are so many. Every page is absurd. But one of the things that's just funniest to me as a lawyer is these people have no, first of all, as you say, it's not defamatory, right? That's not defamatory. Defamatory means something that not only just casts you in an unpleasant light, but shows you, it impairs or impugns or damages your reputation,
causes
as an upstanding
loss.
Individual.
Right.
Okay. So it's like, if you stole something, if you raped somebody or committed sexual abuse against somebody, or if you tried to launch a coup and you were falsely accused of those things, you would have a potential defamation claim. And then the other thing that has to be shown, I'm leading to the thing that is the most absurd, but the other thing you have to show is actual, ultimately you have to prove is damage to reputation. I don't think in 2025, it is possible to damage Donald Trump's reputation. He's a convicted criminal. He's been adjudicated to be a sexual abuser in a case where the sexual abuse that was testified to would have constituted rape in the eyes of most individuals and under the laws of most jurisdictions other than New York, which was the law that was applicable. You know, he's a man who tried to overthrow the Constitution through a coup. I mean, there's so many things. He's a pathological liar. You could document tens of thousands of lies that he has told over the years. It really is not, I mean, Donald Trump there's a phrase that doesn't have a real legal significance, but it's sort of a phrase that libel lawyers have. It's like when somebody really can't show damage to their reputation because it's so bad, they're considered to be libel proof. Donald Trump is pretty much libel proof. Okay? You could even call him, you could even suggest that he, I mean, the Epstein
stuff. And yet these media companies keep
settling
with him.
Let's just say the Epstein stuff, I'm not going to say it because I don't want to get sued, but the Epstein stuff provides a basis to say things about Donald Trump that they couldn't say about us. Okay. We'd have a lawsuit. Right. We could sue it. So there's that. But the thing is, too, these are lawyers, right? A lot of this stuff is just dribble. Obviously, there are lots of pictures in the complaint because, you know, Donald Trump is not so great with words. Did you see his speech yesterday that he read in front of the king? He's like, it's a struggle for him to read. But let's set that aside. There were pictures in this complaint, just like the way they used to put pictures. I don't know what they do now, but in the first Trump administration, they realized if you do a normal PowerPoint with like bullet points that have substance on them, Trump will ignore it and he will just start looking around and start talking about himself and he gets distracted.
He's like pictures of gorillas and sharks. Is that what they
No. The way they used to keep his attention was they would put his name on every page and they would put pictures on it, including pictures of him. And that held his attention. That's like literally what they did for, you know, when he was taking briefings, which was not all that frequently.
What a country.
The complaint is like that. I mean, it's just an embarrassment. It's like written by fourth graders and fifth graders and sixth graders, but anyway, here's the most absurd thing. These are fucking lawyers. All right. There's a doctrine. I'm not sure a lot of our viewers who are not lawyers have heard of the case of New York Times against Sullivan, which is one of the most important mm-hmm. First Amendment cases in our history. It is the case that basically set a higher standard for defamation as it relates to public figures. If you are a public figure and somebody says something arguably untrue about you, first of all, you do have to prove to win a defamation case that the statement was untrue. But you also have to show that the person making the statement about you, the public figure, and this is the price of being a public figure, was made with actual malice, which another phrase for it is the reckless disregard. But these are actually terms of art under the law. Mm-hmm. Actual malice does not actually mean malice in the sense that I hate that politician. Okay? Now, it may be true that somebody who lies about a politician and intentionally says something false about the politician hates the politician. That's probably true. But actual malice doesn't actually, that's not the requirement. Reckless disregard could be you're extremely careless. That's the way the normal language you would normally interpret. But even that's not actually the standard. The standard of intent that a defamation plaintiff has to prove is, even though it's called actual malice and reckless disregard, is the person making the statement has to actually entertain serious doubts as to the truth of what they're saying. In other words, they don't have to know for sure that it's false, but they have to have enough information in front of them to actually think, well, this may or may not be true. It probably isn't true, but I'm just going to say it anyway. All right? And that was established in a case called St. Ammons against Thompson in 1960-something, 64 maybe. And these lawyers proceed on the proposition that actual malice is people don't like Trump. And that's not, it's like, it's not even close to being the law. And their whole complaint is based upon this thing. It's like, guys, just all you had to do is read, pick two Supreme Court cases out of the dozens that have dealt with the actual malice standard and you would know, oh, we can't write it that way.
That's amazing.
But these lawyers are fucking idiots. And not only are they fucking idiots, one of the problems here is that Donald Trump can bring frivolous lawsuits like he did against Hillary Clinton using a parking lot attendant lawyer who's no longer a U.S. attorney. In Florida, they got hit with like $1 million in sanctions. Trump, no, $1 million is nothing anymore. It was never anything really for Trump. It's nothing, especially today when he's, grifting on crypto. So,
yeah. Right.
These lawyers should be sanctioned. Okay. These lawyers who are probably doing this and they're probably not going to get paid, they're probably doing it to curry favor with the president because somehow they think that they will get some benefit in the future, like me. Maybe they'll get a Supreme Court justiceship, like as you said, or maybe they'll get something, they're in the president's orbit and they'll get something.
Assistant U.S. attorney, like Alina Hava, right?
No, she was an actual U.S. attorney.
Oh, sorry. An actual U.S. attorney.
Yeah. No, these people think that, they just want to suck up to power. They just want to feel important. Or maybe they want a nice table at Mar-a-Lago or an invite to the Christmas party at Mar-a-Lago.
Who would sanction them? Like, how does that work?
All right.
So tell me, how do the sanctions work? Who would do this? Are there ways to stop lawsuits like this? What's going to happen next? Is this thing just going to get tossed? Or is he going to be able to talk about his $15 billion lawsuit for forever? Like,
it's going to get tossed at some point because the New York Times actually has good lawyers, and the New York Times defends the New York Times probably has a whole portfolio of libel actions at any given time, most of which we probably haven't even heard of.
Right.
And so, they have in-house counsel that deal with this. And then they have very, very skilled outside counsel that are managed by the inside counsel. And they've handled cases that are much, much, much more substantive and potentially dangerous than this one. Because, you put out a lot of words, something bad is going to happen sooner or later. This lawsuit is a joke. And this lawsuit will be dismissed like handily and readily soon enough. And the New York Times is just going to, they'll file their motion to dismiss and get rid of it.
How long will that take?
It really depends on the judge's docket and the judge's workload.
Are these months or years?
Look, I like to think that if I were a federal judge, I'd be pretty fast in terms of, you know, I never liked it when judges took too long with decisions because it really is bad for the system. But this isn't hard. This is a particularly easy case. And I could see some judges in this country would dismiss it, what we say in the law, sua sponte, on their own motion because it's so frivolous. But, you know, I don't think this case, and again, unless you have a judge who is swamped or old and lazy or something, or who doesn't move quickly, I don't know who the judge is. I don't know why they picked this particular district court, which actually it's in Middle District of Florida, not even a district in which Mar-a-Lago was in. I don't know how fast the judge will rule, he or she, but in the normal course with any decent judge, this will be gone in a few months at the latest. And I think the real question would be the sanctions that we were mentioned. And what a federal judge can do is there are a number of provisions, both under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and under the United States Code, Title 28, that permit courts to sanction attorneys or litigants for filing frivolous pleadings. And in fact, when you sign one of these pleadings, there's a signature page at the end of every complaint, and you saw the signature page on this one with those lawyers that we've never heard of. You are representing, under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11, that you have a sound, factual, and legal basis for the claims that you are asserting in the complaint. And there is no way, there is no way any reasonable lawyer could have drawn that conclusion and signed their name to that pleading consistent with their obligations under Rule 11. And, you know, I basically think that what should happen here is, after a case is dismissed, the court can, you know, where they can make a motion to dismiss and also say, we also would like Rule 11 sanctions. And the court can issue an order to show cause where you have to say to the defendants, not only we're dismissing the case, but you have to show us why you think that you had a basis to bring this lawsuit. Because it certainly doesn't look to me, I'm the federal judge speaking here,
sure,
that you had a basis. And I think this would be the perfect case for Rule 11 sanctions. And the New York Times hires good lawyers. So this is, even though this is a frivolous complaint and you could have a decent second year associate write the brief to dismiss it, you know, it could be expensive for these small law firms, not for Donald Trump. I mean, you know, Donald Trump,
Can we kick the New York Times for a minute, though?
Yes.
Guys, I just want to kick the New York Times. So this is the Times public response. This lawsuit has no merit. It lacks any legitimate legal claims and instead is an attempt to stifle and discourage independent reporting. The New York Times will not be deterred by intimidation tactics. That's very, very good. I don't know if you remember Joe Kahn, the executive editor of the New York Times. He sat down for an interview with Ben Smith about a year ago when we had this election where Donald Trump was one of the two candidates for office, a guy who was a convicted felon and had attempted an insurrection. Yeah. And Ben Smith asked Joe Kahn, he said, is there a reason that the Times is clearly reluctant to talk about the stakes of this election and the threat that this guy poses to democracy? And Joe Kahn said, it's our job to cover the full range of issues that people have. At the moment, democracy is one of them, but it's not the top one. Immigration happens to be the top of the polls, and the economy, inflation is second. Should we stop covering those things because they're favorable to Trump and minimize them? And now the authoritarian is trying to stifle your independent reporting. Fuck you. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. All right. Lisa Cook, who got to vote on lowering interest rates yesterday, the lady who sits on the Federal Board of Reserve Governors. So I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with her lawsuit. So Trump fired her for cause. She decided to fight back. God bless her. An appeals court has rejected Trump's attempt to fire her so far. We've also had reporting that the cause which was levied against her appears not to be true for her, but does appear to be true of other cabinet level appointees within the Trump administration, possibly, allegedly, including Scott Bessent.
Scott Bessent.
So I guess my question is, though, does any of that matter? Because it does look to me like going forward, this just winds up at the Supreme Court. And once it's at the Supreme Court, the question isn't really about cause. The question is really like unitary executive.
Yep.
Can the president just fire Fed yep. members? Forget all this stuff about showing cause or not showing cause. Those are distractions. And the Supreme Court is just going to say yes.
Yeah, I think that's a not unreasonable view of the case. And I think if I had to bet where this was going, that is at least 50-50 on that. I mean, we've talked about the whole question under the law, under this case called Humphrey's executor. We've talked yeah. about it in the context of the FTC commissioner, because Humphrey's executor was actually about the FTC. I mean, the ultimate question that's going to determine not just this case, but the cases involving other people that Trump has purported to and remove over the last several months, it is going to come down to what restraints can Congress put by statute on the president's ability to remove officers who are exercising executive power. And there's a lot of reason to believe, as we've discussed in the past, that the Supreme Court is ready to say, a majority of the court is ready to say, that Congress really can't restrict those removals, because the president, in order to exercise the kind of control that he is entitled to exercise under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. It's all his power. And in order for him to exercise mm-hmm. his power, he has the authority to remove basically people at will.
I mean, George, there's clear as day that the founders wanted a king.
They wanted a, you know, you're not even the king can do this today, right? The king can't even, Charles can't remove officers today, right? Because the king is actually subject, you know, the sovereignty resides in the king because he embodies the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. But the power of government is actually in the king in Parliament. And so if Parliament passes a law that says the king can't do something, constitutionally he can't. Of course, you know, but we have a much, you know, we don't quite look at it that way, even though we're not supposed to have a king. And I have to say, the arguments, I have more sympathy than most critics of the Trump administration for the argument that somehow the removal authority cases from Humphreys and executives went the wrong way. I go back and forth on what standard I would apply instead, which is hard, because I do think Congress should be able to put some restraints on the executive's power to remove people in certain positions. But I sympathize with the notion that you can't just take executive power, for example, like the FTC has this multi-member body, the SEC has this multi-member body. There, people are appointed for terms, can't be removed other than cause. You couldn't put the entirety of the executive power into a committee that the president appointed but had limited power to remove. You couldn't do that to the defense. There has to be some line. I honestly don't know what it is. I think that maybe if you gave me a position at a law school and locked me in a library for 2 or 3 years, I might come up with a position that would probably be wrong. But the problem here is the practical results of taking that law that everyone has relied upon, that Congress has relied upon for basically a century, and just sort of throwing it out you know, it's really drastic, because one of the things about the Federal Reserve is that people have relied on its independence, that it's not subject to the political whims of who's in Congress and what the president wants at any given moment. They have specific objectives in regulating the money supply and interest rates that are designed to promote growth without inflation. And that sometimes requires them to do something that presidents don't like. If we see some inflation, they may have to raise interest rates, which could cause employment to drop. And, you know, presidents don't like that happening when in years ending in four, you know, divisible by four. And Donald Trump, obviously, he doesn't really, he loves debt. He loves owing money. So he doesn't care about inflation. Inflation's great because it means that the amount of money that you pay is worth less than what you agreed to pay when you borrowed in a non-inflationary time. It's a very dangerous thing when it comes to the Fed. And it was always thought that one of the things that would deter the Supreme Court from overruling Humphrey's executive, the current law that basically allows the FTC to exist and the Federal Reserve to some extent with a qualification there, is Humphrey's executor. The thing about it is that overruling that case in too broad a fashion would undermine the economy because people would no longer have confidence in the monetary stability of the United States of America. And maybe the reserve currency of the world is already shifting away. People are kind of getting more skittish about the dollar, if I understand what's going on out there correctly. I mean, it would have grossly detrimental effects to the United States. And if people stop buying dollar-denominated debt of this hugely debtor nation, this huge debtor nation that is running huge deficits and increasing its debt significantly with each year, it's like all of a sudden our borrowing costs could go up, and that would compound the problems that we now have, including problems caused by tariffs.
George,
so it's yes,
buddy, I got some good news for you. I never get to do this. I never get to bring you good news. I am fully confident that the Supreme Court is going to course correct on this. I just know it'll happen, because the next time there's a Democratic president, if he wants to, say, remove Federal Reserve Chairwoman Maria Bartiromo, the court is absolutely going to understand why the president is not a king and he has to abide by limits. And that will prove to the rest of the world that our Federal Reserve Bank is independent.
After the dollar has been decimated. But okay.
Where? All right, we got to move on to Letitia James. The Trump administration is trying to convince prosecutors in Virginia to bring charges against her for mortgage fraud. This despite the fact that investigators have not found any evidence supporting these charges. They've been at this for like 5 months, George. And last month, Ed Martin sent a letter to Letitia James's attorney, where he said that if she resigned from office as the New York Attorney General, it would, quote, serve the good of the state and the nation, and her resignation from office would give the people of New York and America more peace than preceding. He would, quote, take this as an act of good faith. So Ed Martin said that he will stop investigating her if she resigns. Is that legal? That seems like extortion. Or is it not extortion when the government does it?
It's probably not extortion when the government does it, unless they're doing it for some, you know, personal benefit. I don't know. I haven't thought that through. I mean, look, Eagle Ed. Is it Eddie Eagle or Eagle Ed? Well, I forget what they call
it. Eagle Ed is his preferred.
Eagle Ed. I don't think he's ever read the Just DOJ manual. And I don't think this is the proper way to do what can be what has been done in the past. It is not uncommon. And this is not a defense of the lawyer, because this is not really what he's doing in a fair fashion. Sure. It is not uncommon in political corruption cases for settlements, meaning plea deals or decisions not to prosecute or non-prosecution agreements, to include a resignation, an agreement to resign, and an agreement to refrain from participating in public office. It is a card that potential or actual defendants in public service who are being charged with political corruption can kind of get out of or minimize jail.
What if they haven't been charged?
Well, you know, it could happen. Well, here's what I'll give you an example that actually has happened.
Okay.
Spiro Agnew. He was investigated while he was vice president for accepting bribes payoffs that he was receiving, a stream of payments. He continued to receive them as vice president, but they were for his work or corrupt actions as, I think, first county executive for Baltimore County and then governor of Maryland. He was taking cash basically for approving racetracks, something like that. And the investigation started in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Maryland, and some really dogged young prosecutors there made the case, and they went to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department said, wow, you got a case. And the Justice Department, which was then run by Attorney General Elliot Richardson and I think Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus, they said, go do this. And the way the case was ultimately settled was that, and he hadn't been charged, but they negotiated with Agnew's lawyers an agreement that he would resign the vice presidency, and a criminal information filed, and charges would be filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, I think in Greenbelt, and he would plead no contest. And he would get no jail time, and he would go back to private life. So it is in the Justice Department manual that one of the objects of political corruption investigations and political corruption charges and indictments is to basically remove the bad people from office so that the state and local and federal government can function without corruption. It's a
poor Spiro, just a man before his time.
It's a legitimate public policy interest. But this is bullshit. That's not what he's doing here. This is all designed. This mortgage fraud thing is, first of all, it doesn't really involve political corruption or the abuse of office, first of all. All right. And second of all, it's factually questionable in a lot of these cases. There's disclosure of assets. When you file, you know, anybody who's applied for a mortgage, they want to know what other properties you have. Yeah. So they'll know, you know, oh, he's got this house in here and this one here. One of them isn't a primary residence. And it's the truth of the matter is that you could have one as a primary residence. You could still have the mortgage and you could decide, you know, I'm going to keep that house, but I want to move someplace where there are trees and birds, and I want to live there most of the time. So I want to get another private residence, and that's going to be my new public residence. And it may not be my primary residence. That may not be a crime, because when you signed one set of papers, your intent was one thing, and when you signed the other set of papers, your intent was the other. And it's not a promise that you're signing that you're this.
You can't ever. When you sign that mortgage there, for 30 years, go anywhere. It can't be your primary residence.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the facts here are, I have to know, I've never studied mortgage documents. You know, I mean, it's like, do you read those mortgage documents? It's like, you know, maybe you've committed a crime. You don't even know it. You got to show criminal intent. These cases are weak. Okay. These cases are weak. But Trump likes them because Letitia James brought cases where there were papers that had inaccuracies in them. Oh, yes, she's a black woman.
She is a black woman. I mean, I do notice
you
that.
You don't think that has anything
Lisa
to
Cook.
Do with it.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Oh, interesting.
Just
interesting.
Saying.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. So this isn't about that. This is about the case that Letitia James brought and won, and then where the damages got cut back recently and got remanded, or I don't know what's going to happen next with it. And the fact that it involved paperwork in real estate, and this is about retribution. Quite simple. And it's shown by the fact, as you pointed out, they're not going after people who they like, who have done, you know, people that apparently more than one cabinet level official, you could make these same arguments about them. And then it turns out that Lisa Cook disclosed when she bought that house in Atlanta that was allegedly, where the papers allegedly were false, it turned out she did disclose to the bank that that was going to be a second home and not a first home.
What does the phrase equal protection mean?
Yes. I mean,
it does seem like laws are supposed to be equally applied, but you know, maybe.
Yeah, the laws will be equally applied. And yes, I mean, I think you could raise an equal protection issue about people being treated differently because of their political views.
Oh.
Or their race.
Well, we sent you. All right. So, George, this happened while you and I were out. Last month, the Supreme Court issued a decision on the racial profiling stuff with ICE. The case can ICE use just a person's skin color or the language they're using as probable cause for detention? A lower court had said, no, they may not. The Supreme Court didn't say anything. The Supreme Court said, yes, the lower court is overturned. So go ahead and do your raids and grab people who are brown. But there was no written opinion except for Brett Kavanaugh, who had to get his own. He had a lot of feelings on his chest that he had to get out. I want to talk about his feelings.
Okay.
Here's the one question I want to ask, though, because I feel like there was a decision in 2023 about whether or not college admissions offices could use race as one factor in their decisions as to whether or not to admit someone. The Supreme Court was very cranky about that. They did not like that one bit, because that would be bad if colleges considered race as one factor. But if it's law enforcement deciding whether or not to detain you, well, then it's fine. Is there a conflict between those, George, or is that five by five? It's all there's a seamless garment of legal philosophy running right through it.
No, you are absolutely correct to point out the tension. I mean, the standard doctrine today of equal protection law, this is the actual equal protection clause that we're talking about here, is that racial characteristics, racial classifications, when the government engages in classifying people on the basis of race, they have to have a really, 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 really good reason for doing that. And it's basically should be the virtual kiss of death for any government action if it involves treating people differently on the base of race, color, or national origin. Now, the difficulty with that over the years has been trying to justify affirmative action in its strongest form. You know, affirmative action, you know, is a euphemism that refers to a lot of different things in the way that DEI has come to. But when you are manifestly treating one group differently than another, and it's a racial classification, you should lose. And I'm someone here who has always been very much against reverse racial discrimination. Okay. I'm not like some people, and I'm not going to be inflammatory by naming any names, who use this issue as race baiting. because that's even more offensive to me. But yeah, I get it. I don't think that the government should be able to say we need a 10% quota or a 15%. The state of California and acting through the chancellors of the University of California at such and so can say we got to have a class that's 15% of a certain race and we're going to treat people differently to get there. And that is, in fact, still that is illegal even under traditional the Bakke decision in the 1970s. The question is, well, what actually is sort of not quite engaging in direct racial discrimination, but kind of using proxies for it. And the standards have been kind of looser for if you're trying to help racial minorities than they are if you're trying to help white people. And I've always had some discomfort with that. But this is a no-brainer here. Okay? If you're saying that it's bad to discriminate against white people in, I don't know, college admissions, I don't know which case you were just referring to there, which I think it is, although I would figure out ways to try to help disadvantaged people and to try to create, I do think that it's better to have classes of students that are diverse geographically and talent-wise and ethnically and whatnot, because I think it creates for a better learning environment. But if you engage in direct racial discrimination, the government should lose most of the time, almost all of the time, unless they really have something good. And this is real racial discrimination that they're engaging in, because the number of people it's like, you can't assume when you're walking the streets of Alhambra, California, that somebody who has dark skin and black hair and speaks with a slightly Spanish accent or something like that is, you know, an immigration scofflaw. That doesn't make any sense. And it is absolutely 100% racial discrimination of the sort that traditionally, since, you know, over the last 50 years, I mean, let's leave apart Plessy and the period between Plessy and Brown. It's illegal. It's antithetical to what we've come to understand the Constitution to mean and what the framers of the 14th Amendment, who were way ahead of their time, intended to mean when they provided that all people should be subject to the equal protection of the laws. And it's an outrage.
So what does it say to us that the majority, and I actually give Kavanaugh some credit for like putting his reasoning down on paper.
Yeah, at least we know what he's thinking.
Right. But for the majority, I can understand the majority not issuing an opinion if it was upholding a lower court. But they're not. They're overturning a lower court decision. And to just do it silently.
Yeah, no, that is
case,
absolutely.
Which is so, is that contempt of America? Like, I just don't, people. Like, I, you know.
Whether it's contempt of the American people or contempt of, it's a very, very, it makes understanding and enforcing and applying the law much more difficult. And it is becoming an object of absolute frustration, if not rage, on the behalf of lower court judges of all sorts of ideological and persuasions, because it's like they don't know what the law is, but they're somehow obligated to follow these what are called shadow docket decisions or emergency docket decisions when the court doesn't actually say why it fucking did what it did. Right. It may be, you know, it could be that there's some unique aspect to this case that made it insufficient to have relief. But again, as you say, if you're reversing the district court, which actually explained its reasoning.
Right. This is what I'm saying. Right.
You have no idea which proposition, which step in the logical chain that the district court used to get to the result that the district judge got to was wrong. And you have no idea whether if you're coming up with a case that's similar or slightly different, you know, what is it? Is this case different or the same?
the way we apply the law is we try to match up the cases in front of us, if we're a judge or if we're lawyers arguing a case, with what's happened in the past. And we make arguments. This case before your honor is like case A, where the party on my side won. And the other side will say, well, but there's case B. And then you start getting into an argument. Well, what's similar about A and what's similar about B? If the court does not explain itself, lawyers have no idea what to argue. And judges who are supposed to be bound by the decisions of the Supreme Court don't have any idea what the decision is that they're applying that they're supposed to be bound by. And it's really, really problematic the way the court has been overturning temporary decisions or preliminary decisions of the lower courts without telling anybody why they're doing it. And they're doing it not because they want to cause difficulty, but they're doing it because they're not really institutionally and temperamentally suited to this kind of litigation. It's a 9-person court, and you're going to get, you present something in
for now
under a deadline.
Well, it's a 9-person court for now, George.
For now, it may be, God only knows. I mean, the Democrats would make it a 200-person court, and Trump would make it a 1-person court. Chief Justice and associate justices, or a 3-person court, a 2-person court.
Where are you on expansion? I ask Sarah this once a month. I take her temperature because my theory is that before this is all over, Sarah is eventually going to come around and be where I am on Supreme Court expansion.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know where either of you are, but
she's against it. She's the traditionalist. No, you can't do that. And I just feel like
expansion. Yeah. Okay. One of the problems we have with this 9-person court is that you have 9 people, and one of the problems here, which is why I say the court's not institutionally capable of dealing with these emergency cases, is that they can't come to a consensus of why they're doing what they're doing. So that's why they don't write anything. It's because, three justices may think one thing, one justice may think another, and 2 more justices may think something else, but they don't have time to explain it or harmonize their views or talk to each other to try to say, okay, I see what you're saying. Maybe we can craft something in between that at least provides some guidance to the lower courts. It's just they're not institutionally capable of it. And I think expanding the court to make it a 15-member court or a 13-member court is not going to help that problem. What I do think I like, which is, very controversial, but it's something that a lot of commentators have suggested could be true. And I think I think there's a debate about whether or not it can be constitutionally accomplished under the Constitution. I think there are ways to do it, but maybe I'm wrong. I haven't really analyzed it. Would be to create a court that is greater than 9 members, but sits in panels of 9. And the way you... that's actually the way the United States courts of appeal work. Because what happens is, let's say you take the Second Circuit is like 12 or 13 judges. That's the federal appeals court that sits in New York. That covers cases coming out of Connecticut, Vermont, and New York. And what happens is, after a certain age, the judge gets to retire. And they hear fewer cases, but they still have their Article 3 powers in judgeships, their judgeship, which is the reason why that has to be maintained, is because Article 3 of the Constitution provides federal judges with life tenure subject to good behavior. So you can't just say at age 65 or after 10 years, you're gone. But you can give them a different status. And there's also the fact that these courts of appeals, which may, like in the Second Circuit, they're 12 members or 13 members, I forget the right number. And in California, they're like, the Ninth Circuit, there's like 20, I don't know how many there are, it's crazy. But they only sit in panels of 3. to and they can bind the entire court. They don't have to sit all at once, although they sometimes sit en banc, and you can have that in the Supreme Court. Yeah. But what you could do is basically say, the Supreme Court shall sit in panels of nine of the nine most junior justices. Okay. The number of justices could vary over time in this. What you would do is you would say each president gets to appoint a justice every other year. And then, but you take the nine least senior persons. So you get all, you basically, you're kind of getting new blood into the court and into the decision-making process over time, which means these people feel, here's what's the important part of it, they feel less powerful, okay? They feel like, you know, they can't really have agendas because they really are not there. Like, it's like if you're appointed to the Supreme Court at age 40, like, or 38 or whatever Thomas was, it's like you're going to be there for 40 years.
Right.
And it's like, that's just too much power for anyone, man. So I think that having some kind of a system where it sits in panels of not all of the justices, although maybe you could have en banc when there's a particularly difficult case where all of the justices sit. And you could have some kind of a system that allows each successive administration to get an appointment or two, probably two, so that you're just less likely to have these ridiculous confirmation fights and these litmus tests, and you are less likely to have a court that thinks that its job is to change the law and create some ultimate vision of what the law is instead of just deciding
castle in the sky in front of them. Yeah. We're going to do a whole show on that at some point. I'm going to talk very briefly about Kavanaugh's concurrence, though, because he says two things that jumped out at me. The first is, he says, and I'm just going to read from his concurrence, the questioning in those circumstances is typically brief, and those individuals may promptly go free after making clear to the immigration officers that they are U.S. citizens or otherwise legally in the United States. Typically seems to be doing a lot of lifting there as a word, because it may be true. I have not seen, and I'm curious as to how Kavanaugh could make the determination on this. Has somebody cataloged all of the interactions with the time on them, like, you know, running the clock? Because I'm pretty sure that's not true. So okay. He's just asserting a fact into reality. Right. But also, we do have a number of documented cases where it has not been brief and where the people who are detained are here legally or, in fact, are even U.S. citizens. So, like, at what point does it tip over to, like, hey, most of the time it's not onerous. It's onerous only a couple times.
Well, here's the thing. This goes back to my point about the court being institutionally and temperamentally incapable of handling these expedited cases. I mean, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is a smart guy. And, you know, I've met him. He's a nice guy. But I don't think he's ever tried a case. I don't think he was ever, maybe he was for a very brief period of time in his career.
George!
But here's my point. My point is, and this, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is when these cases go up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court is used to dealing with cases where the record is well developed. There may be a full trial. There may be a summary judgment record with lots of papers and findings that they have to defer to made by the lower courts. Or it may well be that the issue is purely one of law by its nature. Like, for example, the birthright citizenship case. There's really no factual issue to be resolved there, except in individual cases. But that's easy once you decide what the law is. Appellate courts, and particularly the highest appellate court, two levels above reality, where the case gets tried and where you have witnesses and you look at the documents and there's people actually studying what the hell actually happened on the ground in the manner that you're discussing. You know, how is this really applied? You can't just, you know, you can't try a case and just, it doesn't happen that One side says, oh, it's just 3 minutes of questioning, and the court accepts that. The other side gets to put on evidence and say, no, that's not how it happens. These people are hauled off and they're beaten up and then they're held in jail for 5 days. And then sooner or later they say, oh, you've got a passport. We'll let you go. We don't know. It could be either. It could be both. That's why we have trial courts to hold trials. And the whole purpose of these emergency cases, these temporary restraining orders and preliminary injunctions, is not to decide the whole case permanently or to even decide the facts of the case in a binding fashion that can go up and have deference in the courts, in the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court. It is to preserve the case so that you can have the trial to actually find out what the fuck was going on. But when you have these cases going up to a Supreme Court that doesn't have time to even agree on a rationale, and you have justices like Kavanaugh, who basically, I don't think have, you know, I mean, maybe he's tried a case, and then I apologize, he can sue me for libel. But I don't think he's got a lot of experience in sifting through facts and questioning witnesses and understanding the nuances of evidence, okay? I mean, he's better off as an appellate judge where you have specific findings that have been affirmed by a court of appeals that then you have to accept as the basis for your legal decision. This court, again, is just not set up to do this stuff.
Well,
and
okay.
Now, I understand they have to do it from time to time because sometimes there are egregious things that happen in the lower courts, and it could be that a temporary decision of a lower court creates some kind of a harm that's just not justified by what's presented to the court. It's an example of why the court needs to stay away from these cases and not issue these decisions except when it's absolutely positively necessary to prevent some really bad thing from happening as the result of an erroneous preliminary or temporary decision of a district judge. And so what they're doing instead is they're doing this on the basis of shaky records, questionable evidence, assumptions in their own heads that may or may not be ultimately supported by trial evidence and may or may not be supported in the actual record that the district judge had in front of her. And then they're issuing these decisions that don't tell anybody why they decided what they decided. It is a completely, absolutely fucked up system. And the Supreme Court is doing a great deal of harm to this country and to the rule of law by using and abusing its emergency docket in this fashion.
George, that's going to be the last word. Supersized show. People were complaining that you were gone, and so we gave the people what they wanted today. 9 hours of George Conway explaining everything.
Ranting
to me.
And raving.
Guys, we'll be back soon. George, thank you, buddy. Good luck, America.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption to the legal tangles and troubles that are growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, God. And close.